but I think we still, one other thing, I think it might be an interesting idea if I invite a few people to join us on our weekend in December who do interesting work on the social economy, if they can find their own funding. I mean, I don't have resources for it. So, for example, I sent you all an email about Craig Boswich, I guess is his name or something. He has an extremely interesting website about solidarity economy. So I invited him. Mm-hmm. I said, do you want to come to our retreat? He said, sure. So he teaches at Haverford, actually, in political science. Did you know him?
No, my last year was his first year.
I see. So he's a young guy teaching at Haverford and clearly doing good work on the solidarity economy version of the social economy stuff. And so he'll come. And I'm going to also ask Margie Mandel from the Quebec group. And Anne, if you can think of some people mm-hmm. who might want to come. Mm-hmm. So if it ends up that we get five or six outsiders who come, that'll affect a little bit how we might organize it. And it might mean that we'd want to make Sunday afternoon part of the weekend. Normally these weekend events that I organize, they end after lunch on Sunday. But we might then extend it so we could have a day with these visitors and then a day of the presentation of our research or something like that. But if any if anybody in connection with this, as you begin doing work on your projects and think of people, I'd be happy to invite other, you know, people as well. Okay. so we've done Roman numeral one.
Good.
One.
Good.
Thank you.
Okay. Given the time constraints, let's do a slightly different procedure now. I also feel good. I think almost everybody was participating in the discussion, so we've got kind of good symmetrical. Nobody is dominating the discussion. So let's now, instead of just going down, I'll open it to anybody to pick one. So anybody who's really eager to have their theme talked about, and which we haven't really, that we haven't intersected from what we've already mm-hmm. talked about. So if you're shy, your number won't be called. If you're eager, you can get in on it. So whoever jumps first gets the next. God, everybody's so nice. You're all deferring to everybody.
I'm really interested in this question of the state and the social economy, mm-hmm. because it was certainly a lot of the authors this week talked about, you know, the intersection of the state and the social economy. There are practical reasons why you know, social economy organizations are supported by the state. Subsidies or funding that, you know, Eric mentioned. I continue to be interested in the Self-Employed Women's Association in India, which is a network of cooperatives. And in order for them to start to register as an organization, they needed to get legal regulations changed. So their legal constraints on social economy organizations. But then beyond the practical resource issues, it seems like social economy organizations in a sense challenge the state. In the sense, if we're talking about an organization which provides services to a constituency, then unless this is a population that's completely neglected by the state just doesn't pay any attention to them. If the state has some investment or some interest in that constituency, maybe as like a political group or or for whatever reason, then the presence of that social economy organization in some sense is going to have to be permitted by the state or given some. So that's my kind of idea about it.
Do you think that's kind of, you think that social economy organization will be in that case in tension with the state?
Mm.
And would you call that like being in tension, or you know, how would you define it? Because I think, for example, I think it was one of the articles that we're reading about the third sector in Europe, which is growing, and apparently because of especially the fiscal and budget crisis of the governments at the moment, it seems like states or governments would be, you know, more than happy to get rid of some of these social services or, you know, healthcare and these kinds of things that they were doing in the, you know, welfare state age. Because and they see, in fact, that as some kind of, you know, a potential salvation, you know, from the crisis as, you know, one way of reducing their fiscal deficits. And that's why, you know, this in general, I think the term, rather than being called non-profit, has turned out to be third sector, because it's non-profit is entails something a little bit more restricted, whereas third sector is, you know, government is actively engaged and in fact wants them to be involved for that particular reason.
Yeah,
I mean, the way I think pretty much about the same thing is like the social economy reaction, kind of problems like declining services the state can't provide anymore. Was it like fulfilling needs, like from it, like standing kind of on its own feet? So is it kind of, is its development, how closely related is the development of the social economy to the state? Is it only acting always in a reaction to the state, or is it acting on its own kind of behalf, kind of catering to like its own constituency and then serving like needs that are independent of the state? Because I think that's quite important, whether you want to talk about it, but whether it has a transformative role or not. Because if it's just reactive to the state, then kind of just, you know, fulfills a function that the state can't fulfill anymore, and therefore kind of props up, I would say, like the dominant
system. Many of them have contracts with the governments, like for providing various services. So it's like formal contract-based arrangements.
It's true.
Yeah. Many of them. In Europe, at least.
Right. Well, here too.
Here too.
And
here too?
Here.
Yeah.
Yeah.
There are at least...
So services in Dane County.
Even prison.
Yeah.
That,
yeah.
That,
yeah.
That's,
yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's true.
Well, some of the contracts are with for-profit, too.
Yeah.
The Lockheed Martin military contractor runs the welfare system in Texas. Just got the contract to do the welfare. At least it did. I don't know if it still does. But.
There are also some cases where organizations that are seem to be clearly social economistic, like community health centers, are receiving government grants and contracts while operating in the same places, sometimes even just almost next door to a government-run health clinic. So they are, in a way, they're competing. I mean, if you want to think about it that way, but the person can decide which one to go to. And every dollar that's spent on the nominally private-run organization is a dollar that's not spent on the direct government provision of the services.
But it's coming probably from different pots, right?
Usually, yes.
So
although sometimes those pots... mix too.
Medicare.
So, I mean, in the case of Cook County, the Cook County government does give grants to community health centers, and it operates its own community health clinics at the same time. So sometimes it's even the same pot.
But it's the same level of government, but is it the same agency that's deciding?
That's true, it's not.
So, I mean, often
the relationships get complicated, but yeah.
Often, from a budgetary point of view, the city budget is cabin into different chunks, and a skilled civil society organization knows the structure of the pots of money,
mm-hmm.
and knows, in addition, the rivalries between the bureaucrats involved,
mm-hmm.
and then can often play a game with that. Rather than seeing this as state
direct it, that is the state is this unified actor that is deciding, well, should we fund this community clinic in order to co-opt these people, or should we just do it ourselves? The state is a kind of loosely coupled, internally contradictory, often incredibly inefficient organization internally, in which there are some good people and some crappy people, some people with good ties to activists, some people with none. And then the activist communities, grassroots people who have stuck with it, get to know who they can talk to and who they can't.
So then one question that comes out of that is, are these tensions with the state, where you have state-funded organizations that are competing with or slash replacing slash supplementing state services, are those tensions all coming out of contradictions from within the state? They may be, or there may be even larger contradictions that are intersecting with or partially exogenous to the state. Where are they all coming from?
In a lot of these contexts, there's an acute sense of dilemma by the civil society organizations as to whether or not they want to go to the state for funds because of the skills that they need to be able to get those funds. They have to learn how to write grants. They have to learn how to suck up to different political constituencies. And then you have to learn how to discipline their own riffraff. And so there are certainly associations engaged in civil society type things who won't go to the state, even though the money's there. On rather the same kind of logic as a century and a half ago, socialist parties were worried about should we run elections or not. If you compete for elections, then you get sucked into a particular kind of game, which then you lose autonomy. And
it occurs to me that the reason the state is in that predicament is because they are ostensibly there to represent all people, which by definition is not going to be common. There's not going to have common interests. The social economy has the option to represent its own constituency and eliminate the controversies and the disagreements, right? That is supposedly across governments, across state, right? So I see those as, whether it's reactive or not, as opportunistic to say, okay, I don't want to play that game. I don't want to have to please everybody. Government's got to please everybody, so I'm going to take it out of there. I'm going to take it out of that. I'm going to take a need that they would like to fill if they could, but they can't agree, because I've got to represent everyone, and I'm going to do it myself as a separate entity.
But this then will never be transformative on a broader scale, right? Because it just caters to this specific need that is there already within this umbrella of the state.
Like in healthcare, for example. Well, a healthcare need is going to exist regardless of what type of government you're going to have, regardless of what type of regardless of anything. That need is independent of the mechanism that would be designed to deliver it or to meet that need.
Michael.
So on the Evers and Levy piece that they do refer to parts of the social economy as coping mechanisms in the context of retreat of state social services. And I think that that's an important point in talking about social economy as simply not even in so much tension with the state, but replacing it when the state retreats. Replacing those services when the state retreats, and sometimes they mention not as well. They're not able to perform as well simply because they have, they're more tightly constricted in what they can do. I think that's an important thing to look at. But I don't think, Emmanuel, that I think I want to get away from the idea that because it's simply reactive, or because it's simply a coping mechanism, that there's also no transformative capacity either. I think that's a dichotomy or something that doesn't need to be drawn, or that I don't see any obvious reason to draw, at least. And so I think for example, if we can argue that when the state provides health services for free to everyone, that this represents a real gain, which does, it decommodifies health services and decommodifies labor to some extent. And this means a real kind of shift in class in the balances of class forces to some degree, one or another. Do you see what I mean? You have a confused look, but if social economy can then step in and do this the same, then either way the class forces are less favorable to the working class when the working class doesn't have access to health care for free, regardless of whether it's state, if it's by state provision or social economy provision. Do you see what I mean?
I think the way, on this particular theme, does a particular context promote or impede transformative possibilities? I think it's very context-specific whether any given relationship opens up or closes off possibilities, as opposed to it being there being some general rule. Often things begin as co-optations, but then they unravel and they become autonomous bases for resistance. Or they begin as autonomous bases for resistance, they're proactive, they're not reactive, but then the leadership gets sucked into some clientelistic relationship with the state. And I just don't think there's a general trans-contextual formula for this. It very much depends upon such things as how cohesive is the state and how unified is it in its strategies in dealing with civil society. How penetrated is the state by particular constituencies? So there are times when, union activists essentially colonize the labor regulation parts of the state, and they turn it to mobilizing, whereas the exact same relationship could be used to control labor. Just depends upon that level of detail of what's going on. So while I do think we want to keep in mind this whole general theme about the transformative potential, the potential can be there even if the practices aren't realizing that potential because of contingent reasons. Yeah.
I was going to give an example. I was in Italy a couple years ago visiting some of the social co-ops in the Emilia-Romagna region, and there they talked about, just from the worker point of view, say in provision of mental health services or daycare. We visited two of those kinds of co-ops, and their point of view, at least from the co-ops, was that the workers in the state-run organization, at this point there were private, there were state-run, and there were these solidarity cooperatives. The workers in the state-run were clearly made more money, but morale and general sort of, morale and kind of hopelessness pervaded them. That's the way they described it. And in the cooperatives, which were providing potentially the same sorts of services, it was transformative, but workers had control, they had participation and decision making and all these kinds of things in their provision of services. So, it's hard to I agree with Eric. I mean, how are you're still taking a snapshot of this one particular time. They could be co-opted or something could happen 5 years from now, but at this one point in time, they were clearly saying that these solidarity co-ops were very different for the workers themselves than the state-run, similar state-run organization.
Yeah.
But this is not related to this. What I'll say. So I'm jumping to something else.
Is there a direct follow-up? Okay, go ahead.
I'm curious about, I think I wrote it here, but I don't know how I will elaborate it. So this was in fact in the book as one of the case studies, but I can talk about it as in a more general way. So for example, it talks about various cooperatives, with various members. So in a way, it's social ownership, and in many of these cooperatives, it tends to be that there are people who are part time or full time employed. And we were discussing before class that that Michael said some of these people are, you know, and in fact Tatiana also said that, that some of these people were on the path to becoming members.
We were talking about Mondragon.
Right. Yes. And but some of them are not.
Right.
And I'm sure there are many cases where, you know, those people are employed there, but they really don't have any prospects for becoming members. So in that case, is this some kind of, you know, kind of hybrid? And, you know, how do we understand it? Because if just, I mean, for me, this is really a confusing or weird case. Just
yeah.
You know, self-contradictory.
Well, that's...
And I mean, especially the relationships between those people, and that's...
Right. So as the French say, c'est la vie. life is confusing. Organizations don't follow our categories. Yeah, and Mondragon has a formal principle which it violates somewhat frequently, that no more than 10% of the workers in a Mondragon cooperative can be non-members. And they have a maximum of, I believe it's 2 years, but it may be shorter than that, that they can be employed, after which they have to either be accepted into the membership group or they are fired. They can't stay on. That's the principle, but it doesn't actually work that way. At times it's been as high as 20%, even inside of the Basque cooperatives. And in the organization as a whole, for the Mondragon Cooperative Corporation now, there are a total of 40,000 worker members who own the entire assets of Mondragon, and about 60,000 employees who don't own anything. Most of those are not in the Basque Country. You know, they're in Brazil and Romania and Arkansas. In Arkansas, there is a Mondragon bicycle factory. They make incredibly high-end road bikes, you know, in the $10,000 to $15,000 a bike range, and they have a factory in Arkansas, and they're just employees of the Mondragon Cooperative in the Basque Country that owns it. So yeah, it's just contradictory and internally inconsistent. They do worry about it, which they wouldn't if they weren't a co-op. So at least that they maybe have a few sleepless nights as a result. Yeah.
Yeah, I think in order to make it less confusing, I think it's hard to think about the situation of Mondragon now as the situation right now, so as a kind of snapshot. But if you understand the reasoning behind taking that kind of decision of having that limit for non-members, and see, for instance, the how that relates to the capacities of reproducing or sustaining the very own existence of the organizations, instead of having continuously a flow of new people, also how that relates to that. So a form of thinking about the organization as a self, of trying to reproduce itself, rather than seeing it just like today. So how those reasonings evolve. And of course, now they also evolve, and then maybe they have perverse consequence. So when that kind of reasoning interact with, you know, the expansion of Mondragon as a corporation, so what happens? So how that relates to racism and that were not necessarily part of the initial perspective of the organization. So you need to take it across time, I would say.
Yeah.
This is a different point, a little bit. So, if organizations, I mean, it would be most, you talked earlier about the actions versus practices distinction, ways of conceptualizing what happens, the effects in the world versus the meanings that people bring to it. Could the same distinction be drawn for organizational things, organizational practices, as a way of understanding what they are and what's motivating them, the effects that are produced in the world, versus organizational actions, the meanings that the members of the organizations are bringing to the things that they're doing? And if so, which is the better way to do it? Think about organizations as actions or organizational practices.
So I'll make a comment on that, but I'd like to get back to the main thing around the state and then some other ramifications of that, the more structural analysis. Let me just make a comment. There's an additional distinction which I make, which again will, I'm reminding people who about this when we, from what we did in 621, for those of you who took that class. And that's, I distinguish between, for example, a political practice and the political aspects of a non-political practice. Right, so political practice more generally is just practices that transform and produce social relations. So there are political aspects of economic practices. When the labor process is organized and you have supervisors and workers go to work every day and work on the shop floor, the dull compulsion of everyday life and all that reproduces and produces particular social relations, even though the purpose of the practice is to transform nature to produce products. I would refer to that as the political aspects of their economic practices. So to call it, to use it as an adjective, political practice, it means its purposes are political, as well as its effects. To say it's a political aspect of a practice then says its purposes can be whatever, but its effects are transforming and producing relations. So all economic practices have ideological and political aspects, but an ideological practice is what we're, I'm engaged in this language, I'm engaged in a political practice, and an ideological practice in this class, as we all are, that is, we are producing subjectivity. That is, we're transforming the cognitive structures of various subjective states in the room. For those of you who are awake, you know, there's some hope. That's what an ideological practice is. The particular type of ideological practice we're engaged in, I think, can also be called a scientific practice. That is, we're trying to transform cognitive structures in a particular way, not just into any old sets of beliefs, but to beliefs that are subordinated to a particular set of criteria. That's why we call ourselves sociologists, so to speak. Anyway, so that's an additional way of thinking through these kinds of complexities. But back to the state. I think this issue of how to think about the relationship of the social economy to the state is a really interesting domain. It's also part of when he's question about the sources of revenue and how that affects. So I thought it might be nice to just segue to that specific question. How does the way you get your revenues affect the functioning of the social economy? If you want to elaborate. Oh, one other just little thing. You notice the very elegant little the diagrams there. I did one manipulation of the diagram, and I'm happy to give. I know some.
What's the intention?
What?
It was your intention, it's blank.
That was blank when it came to me.
Oh.
When I got it, it was blank. So
sorry, yeah.
Something disappeared on the route. But I also, I did a manipulation to keep all the objects together. So my point is, the reason I'm saying this is, a number of people have asked me recently for some reason how I do these kinds of diagrams easily. And I'm happy to give some instructions to anybody. It'll be a 5-minute lesson. The key is that you have to group all the objects together so they stay together. You add text above and below. Otherwise, diagrams tend to disintegrate in the course of. And I can, anybody who doesn't know how to do that in Word, how to draw these diagrams and get all the elements to hang together, I'm happy to give a short lesson. This was a separate matter from the intellectual substance. No, the ones that are blank, they arrived on my.
Sorry, I think it was my fault. Yeah.
They might be there hiding behind the bubble. It's possible. I didn't.
You can try to guess.
You can tell us what to put into the.
Yeah, just the. My idea was very simple, so I was thinking about what's the difference between economic transaction in the market and social economy. So then I
when I draw this diagram, the characteristics of social economy become much clearer to me. So I thought that when the organization or some agencies in social economy get their revenue, get their money from directly from the buyer and consumers, they should satisfy their buyers by providing the products or services. So I thought that this organization cannot, they have some limitation in their, if they have their own some social mission, like transformative mission. And then the second one, the blank is definitely the social organization, non-profit organization.
Mm-hmm.
So sorry, Alex, I missed my point. Traditionally government provides services, and then they get the revenue from the tax. And then now, social organizations get their revenue from the government, and then instead they providing services to the public. So here, what I thought it was.
A nonprofit organization goes in the missing blank.
Yeah.
And on the bottom one, third
private
parties.
Fund. Yeah, private funds.
Private funds, third parties.
The blank one is
at the bottom.
There's some donator,
mm-hmm.
a private donator.
Yeah.
Or charity or any members. So when they get the when the organization gets the revenue, they should obey some guideline of the guideline or some rules provided by the donors or anyone who provide money, like state or. So I thought that the source of revenue has some implication in practice and some provisions of these organizations.
So one way of thinking about these revenue streams is that they define lines of accountability.
Yeah.
Right. So, and that depends upon the nature of the conditionality attached to the revenue. There are government programs which have very weak conditionality. That is, if you satisfy certain criteria, you can get funds for certain sorts of purposes. But there's not a lot of accountability. Other kinds of funding relations have very high accountability. There's auditing, there's progress reports, there's evaluation studies. I mean, all these accountability mechanisms get tied up with the access to the funding. And I think it's reasonable to say this is a distinctive cluster of problems that social economy enterprises face because of the conditions under which they get access to
to funds.
But actually, I mean, think about the Just Coffee Cooperative. They have a certain relationship to their consumers, and that accountability, their consumers demand certain things of them. And so the character of their consumers actually sort of reinforces the social character of their operations. So it has something to do with, like, the constituency that is...
That's the normal market mechanism, which goes by the lofty neoclassical terms, consumer sovereignty, is that the consumers dictate to the firms what the firm produces. And if the consumer is dissatisfied, they'll go to some other firm. It's the exit option. And Just Coffee, to the extent that it relies on ordinary market mechanisms, has successfully found a type of consumer whose preferences were not being met by regular capitalist firms, which values the social mission of Just Coffee. That's how they sell their product, basically. So they make a very big deal of it on their bags. They have the Just Coffee commodity chain compared to the ordinary capitalist commodity chain of coffee as a way of clearly signaling. And they've gone to enormous and effective lengths to make their operations transparent so that sophisticated consumers who are skeptical of equal exchange type fair trade operations nevertheless have very high levels of confidence with them. Now, the cynical view is that's just a really clever marketing strategy. They've kind of figured out how to build their niche and protect it. Of course, I think that's not a correct... We have an expert on Just Coffee here.
Well, it is a marketing strategy. It may be more than a marketing strategy, but that's one of the dimensions of it. I mean, it is...
I
part of how they market themselves.
I think that's not the right description.
Yeah, I think it goes beyond that, to the extent that it's not just, as Eric said, meeting the consumer. They were politically agitating, so they took their product, what they had to offer, and they made it become political. So they organized themselves not only as simply an organization to attend some economic need or to attend for some kind of demand, but they generated something else, which is a political involvement.
And it's a common capitalist strategy, of course, to create needs, not just to respond to them.
Yeah.
And part of their mission is to create a need, that is to create a demand for high quality, high social justice traded goods, of which coffee and I suppose chocolate is the other, is also in that. They don't do chocolate yet, do they? No, but chocolate is another one that falls into this kind of category. So they are using techniques that we find in capitalist firms, but I don't think it's quite right to say that it's a market strategy. Rather, it's a... It's a kind of solidarity building strategy. You know, it's more like what a political party does to build a base. The terms we use in English, advertising, I mean, political parties do advertising. But there's a difference between those political parties that advertise in a marketing sense, that is, they want to create an image, an illusion, to get people to buy their brand, rather than to give them transparent information to only attract people to their brand, as it were, who really care about it.
Mm-hmm.
Right. So that's why I think one could call it a marketing strategy, of course, because it is a market, they're selling stuff. Yeah.
Yeah, I think, Just Coffee goes even, just an example of that. So they contribute to organizing groups of consumers of their coffees, and they organize political trips to the countries where actually coffee is grown. And in general, one of their perspectives on doing that is to make to contribute to transform people that consume their coffee to become activists. So it's really like a party.
I think there is some, I mean, the main characteristic of the capitalist form is not to meet consumers. I think it's to satisfy investors, right? So like satisfying consumers self does not make the form either a capitalist form, I think. And also like consumers are very broad person, right? Broad people, so they also are residents of their like a community, and they are also citizens. So like, the thing to like satisfying the clients or satisfying consumers, I don't think it does not hurt the system. I mean, the way the social social economy organization work. I think it could be a strength. Like for example, if a social economy organization have a broad range of if they have to get some revenue from the consumers or from the clients or from the parents, if it's a daycare center, for example, if they have to get some revenue from that group, they will have a responsibility about that group, and they will hear their demand, or their need or whatever, or their ideology, whatever. They will try to satisfy that. So I think itself is not it's not just a capitalist form characteristic. I think it's a characteristic of an economic organization.
I have another point but to what you are saying, since when the organization social economy try to satisfy their client, it involves the cost. When social healthcare or childcare or any mental health services, if the client definitely want to do the low price for the services, and then to meet their demand, maybe organizations cut their cut wages of the employees or use more volunteer workers, so they can affect the quality of the services. So I think it's a little bit more complicated than what you said. Just satisfying clients.
One important distinction, which is implicit in some of the readings, would be the following. When a capitalist firm is dealing with clients, with customers, of course, the reason why they want to attract customers is because of their investors. But a key part of this relationship is that if the customer isn't satisfied, they exit and go to another firm. That's why it's called consumer sovereignty. A characteristic of many of the kinds of organizations in the social economy is that when customers aren't satisfied, it's not that they leave and go to another social economy enterprise, but rather that there are opportunities for voice. Mm-hmm. So that particularly in these the child care cooperatives that have solidarity boards, if parents aren't satisfied with what's going on, rather than simply go find another daycare center, they go to the meetings of the board and they complain about what's been happening in the daycare center. So that's a classic distinction, exit versus voice. Pure market firms respond to signals that come from exit. Pure participatory democratic organizations respond to voice. The social economy, the family or spectrum of social economy initiatives that we're talking about vary in the extent of the mix between exit and voice. They typically have some of each present. And that's another way that we can begin to think about, you know, these associations and how they how they function and the sense in which they may be hybrid. So the more market-centered social economy enterprises that really are functioning within a market context defined by capitalist firms are likely to face more exit constraints rather than voice constraints. Worker co-ops have the character that because they're owned by the workers, the employees all have voice rather than exit options. But the consumers of the products of a co-op typically have exit and not voice options. Mm. Right. So that's another sense in which they are hybrid organizations. They combine exit and voice, but in different people.
Can you say in the state-run and in the public one, the consumers are left with the option of comply? I don't know how the third one, how Fishman.
The third one is loyalty.
Maybe they won't co-op because there's no chances to exit because you rely on them. But there's also no choice of voice because they are property run and there's
right.
no way to change.
Right. Yeah, and that's why people complain about the state because you can't, voice isn't heard and you don't have any exit option. That's the neoliberal complaint about state failures, that there's no way out.
That's why they advocate for decentralization, because they think that then people will voice by moving between different subnational states in order to voice.
Well, that's exit.
That's how they create the exit option.
The idea for participatory decentralization is to increase voice. That is, to make the distinction between devolution and decentralization. So devolution means moving the service down to the point where, moving the control of the service down to the point where the clients can participate. The users of a service can meaningfully participate in its governance. That's the subsidiary principle or devolution. Decentralization is a geographic principle of, you know, dispersing authority. You can have devolution and still have an integrated system, but you just create participatory bodies at the point where the organization meets the consumers. I think that's probably the way one would want to describe the Quebec childcare system, because the participatory bodies are at the level of the childcare center, but it's an integrated system. There's an association of all these centers, and they do the coordinating and the buying and of supplies and do all sorts of coordinative activity. So it's not a fragmented, decentralized system. Yeah.
Would schools or K-12 schools be described that way? Like Board of Education at the local level?
At the city, because it's a school.
At the district level.
Yeah, so the participatory...
It's run by the state.
Right, so the participatory bodies in school systems tend to be school-based. That is, they're parent-teachers associations. In most school systems, those don't have much power. There are some where there have been experiments in giving real power, so the participation is actually voice. It actually can change policy at the school level. That would be real devolution in the sense of trying to create, because that's the level at which parents can participate. Parents are rarely going to participate in school policy at the city level, you know, because of time constraints, because of information constraints. But at the school level, they will, if there's a point to it, which often there's not.
So like any negative aspects of devolution? Because surely the idea is that there's more information on the local level, right? It's seen as a positive thing. Any negative sides?
Oh, there's tons of negative things. Exclusionary nastiness, all sorts of, you know, there's all sorts of problems that are created if at the more local level you get too much homogeneity. Mm-hmm. And then people want to be exclusionary. So it's, yeah, it's a, I mean, this is, these are the big themes in the sort of new participatory democratic theory about trying to figure out how to increase the weight of more direct democratic participation without creating fragmented, you know, disorganized, without increasing the variance of performance. So the advantage of centralized systems is it tends to reduce the variance across the sites of the delivery of service. Good centralized systems. But it reduces the variance, but it also reduces the accountability and the flexibility, the meshing of the form of delivery to the needs of the particular. It's after 9:30. We only got through. This will be a this will be a typical fate of our seminars. My general feeling, of course, everything's open for us to, you know, somewhat change our procedure. We can more methodically move down. My general feeling is, as long as the discussion is interesting, it's worth pursuing. And it doesn't really matter if we get through all of the agenda items. You've all thought about it. You've read your written down your interrogations. Many of these themes will keep coming up anyway. So I'll try to be attentive when I organize interrogations for next week. Those that cover some of the same themes from this week, but which we didn't discuss this week, then can get foregrounded. Okay.
I have a complete schedule for the week that we're going to go through our homework. Because I have the older
coming
out. There's like a final class activity, which is a conference. And it's Saturday 10 and Friday 10 and Saturday 10. It's a seminar.
Transformative goals versus what?
It's 10 and 11. And the conference.
So, for example, the state provides health for free.
Exactly. Symmetrical.
Social economy.
Yeah, exactly.
Just tell them that.